This is News from the Peak. I'm Joe Mamlin.
On today's show, Maureen Life has a conversation with Terrence LaFromboise. He currently serves as a grant manager with the state of Montana, but is also very involved in the work we've been doing with the Blackfeet Nation and the Pecana Youth Council. So here's Maureen with a little bit more about Terrence and what we can expect on the show today.
So we were excited to have TJ on the podcast because he's been a real leader in the Blackfeet community. He's on our advisory council, as well as an advisor for the Pecana Youth Council. The youth really connect with TJ, and I think that's, you know, a big part of this grant is getting youth voice. And so having TJ on the team to kind of connect us to youth is really important. And he's really just thought of as a cultural carrier in the community, which is some new terminology, which kind of infers someone who's helping, you know, forward on cultural values and traditions. The word elder kind of infers that someone's got some age to them, but he's a younger person. He's just a real pillar in the community, and he's got lots of great stories and lots of great experience. So it's really interesting. You have to kind of like try to follow along because he moves really quickly, but he's got a lot of great information.
He really does. It's a great episode, a really interesting interview, and a fascinating guest. So stick around, and we'll be right back.
Well, welcome to the podcast, TJ. Always great to see you. So glad that you could be on. If you could just give our listeners kind of a sense of what your role in the community and some of the maybe just a brief overview of some of the projects you're working on and kind of what your background is.
Yeah, Terrence LaFromboise, born and raised on the Blackfeet Reservation. I work for the state of Montana under DPHHS as a zero suicide grant manager. And that role is actually coming to an end as the grant closes. And it's been an amazing opportunity. So working at the state, prior to that, I was working at the tribe. I ran the methamphetamine suicide prevention initiative, closed it. There was multiple grant managers, great ones that I worked with in the community. So running that program was my initial start into the work I do. And all while working for the tribe and going to the state, I was in a bachelor's program, and I was also in a master's program. The reality, well, on top of being in this learning environment while servicing community, I was gaining so much in real time, like knowledge and understanding, and really leaning on my experiences. So prior to getting into that program, I graduated early in 2007 and went to a university in Billings here in Montana. And then from there, didn't finish and kind of typical backstory, just learning and getting into these pathways that, you know, were very negative, drugs, alcohol, and using those as scapegoats to continue to hurt others and hurt myself. And learning, going in and transferring to a tribal school where it had that connection to home, like connection to a tribal university, felt really good. and was able to get back into like a physical health where playing basketball for the team and learning through those trials and tribulations to then in 2011, I went into my son was born, who is now 11, and I had a daughter simultaneously who I raised. And my son and my daughter were a big part of my life in 2011, going into probably one of the most life-changing experiences on becoming a father and really learning from my experiences and having this understanding. But it kind of led me into coming home. But in that process of coming home, it was getting back into some of the community things and learning from what was happening around me. And in that time, recognizing there was a whole new frame of understanding that was coming just in that short 5, 6 years of leaving high school to experiencing a wider range of Montana and outside, and then coming home to wanting to just be, just to live and to be a part of the community. I've had a lot of support in my path, people that are influential to me. Dr. Billy Joe Kipp, who was the president at the time of the college at BCC, which is Blackfeet Community College, allowed me to get back into school. So in 2 years' time, coaching, working, going to school, I got my associates in social work, and then I got my associates in addiction studies. And it wasn't until educating myself and having the teachers at Blackfeet Community College that we have, the professors there, really built foundations on a cultural perspective. Then going to university built my bigger and wider horizon on social work and its theories and applications and processes, which then led me to the University of Toronto, which was a bridge program called Bridging the River, Indigenous Trauma and Resiliency Program. So the program was really invested on you can't help others until you help yourself. And in that ideology, there was also cultural foundations that took therapy modalities and broke them down into Indigenous connectable tools. There's always this perceived reality, and we live inside of that all the time. You know, until we are faced with adversity, until we're really in the dumps and really contemplating, you know, staying, going, leaving, and finding ways to work through that, where a lot of Indigenous people have had these experiences, and these are human experiences. This isn't just taken away from Indigenous people, but as human people, we all have shared experiences. And a lot of that is predicated on the educational system, the foundations on what some of our experiences as Indigenous people were laid on, boarding schools and reformation, killing the Indian and saving the man, the manifest destiny, all these things. And we can't focus solely on those experiences, but recognize how the patterns have led to the survival of our people, where there are these tremendous atrocities that are in our timeline. But to look at those and to really heal through that. And I think as communities, we're almost there. There's so much shared experiences now and knowledge coming that we're awakening. And I think that's a whole world thing. We are in this period where we're so hurt and so damaged from years of not healing from those first experiences, are feeling validated for the experiences we've actually had, where other countries like Australia and Canada are doing those things. The TRC report in Canada came from survivors and went through legislation where there are simultaneously things happening now that are happening in the States, and the uncovering of children at boarding schools where our communities knew these things. These were stories were told, and just the silences that we felt, I think reverberate through communities. Forgive me. I think talking about it sometimes, and I think just being already emotional from my previous conversation where my job entails me to work with high risk populations, and
you're in a really safe place, and I appreciate your vulnerability. And there was a report on the news last night just in Colorado about boarding schools and doing historical reviews and like really talking about all of these things. So I'm right there with you on the emotional. I'm with you.
Yeah. And I think you hit it is vulnerability, and not a way where, you know, you've ever, and I think we've all experienced where you try to go seek help in others or professionals. And there is this kind of, well, I'm going to tell you this story, and then you tell me if that meets whatever you're thinking. And it's always kind of like, I'll tell you what's wrong. And it's never just a conversation. It's never just a listening and hearing people's pain. So a lot of like this connection to this wider acknowledgement is, as men, where is that sense, and where was that playbook passed down? And I there's so many Native men groups out there that I want to give a shout out. And there's the Fatherhood Motherhood program that does a lot of great work encouraging men to go back to those roles. And that challenge, though, is the intention with that tool, is you have to create a facilitation that's going to intentionally create those connections. Because just tools itself, if not no knowledge around how to use a tool is useless. I think for me, the work we do in Canada as a trauma counselor, we really break down those intergenerational things through safety spaces. You know, the way you're allowing this, I think the way I've already felt it, which allowed me to be vulnerable, because we do have spaces, and men, we seek those. It's like a safety, putting our back against the wall, where a lot of men, and not even Indigenous men, all men, how, you know, the statistics tell us these things, that the data shows us men are at a higher rate across all races. So there is this issue, and I think understanding that just needs to be addressed. An example for me was in my bachelor's program, I hadn't really had lost anybody besides my grandmother, who was older and was on that precipice. COVID hadn't happened, but it was still hard. I had lost a relative to alcoholism who hurt himself, but it wasn't a suicide. And he was a big part of my life. So there was still tragedy. But during my bachelor's, I graduated summa cum laude. And I was graduating at the top of my class. And I felt really empowered and strengthened by learning social work modalities. But when I transitioned into my master's program, I felt like my experiences was really hard. And I think a lot of that was in the program, you had to look inwardly. Which there was things I think I was holding as just a young man, that we all hold those spaces where we just learn to be resilient through those adverse childhood experiences. And through those, I think I've carried things, and I did. And I've had to learn to let those go. There's so many of us, I think, in community that have different types of survival. You can't just come out. You know, that was the silence that we all carry. Well, at the same time, going through grief, death, because then COVID happened right in the beginning of our program and in the middle of my work. And then there was death. And it was really hard because there were systems that were failing. And if you were keen to those, you could actually see them happening in real time. Just breakdown in leadership, breakdown in structure, breakdown in delivery, breakdown in planning. And we were probably doing things correctly on multiple levels, but there's just always a connector. And a lot of that was you had to have all of it. You can't just take one out and expect it to be what it is. You have to have good communication, good leadership, and then structure, policy, supports, and then you have those, and then it creates awesomeness. But when you take one out, you're looking at dysfunction.
So many things that you said. One of the things about, so you're helping us on this economic mobility and responsible parenting grant, and some of the objectives are tied into so many of the things that you just talked about in your background and your work, and that is, like, from a Blackfeet cultural perspective, what does responsible parenting mean? And some of what we're seeing is that with this historical trauma and boarding schools and people being taken out of, like, a natural state of learning to be a parent, there's been this disconnect. And so you even kind of talked about this a little bit in your own family, like, people are being raised by relatives, and there's just been a lot of trauma, and it kind of is in this cycle. And so part of the grant is really about connecting, for the tribal programs, it's really about connecting kids back to their culture, and teaching kids how to be good parents. So you talked about that program, the motherhood fatherhood program, and that's a big part of this grant. And so I don't know if you have any other, I'm not sure what the question is around that, other than just, like, what does responsible parenting mean for Blackfeet? And, like, in your work, what does that make you think of?
No, and there's no I and I think I've had conversations with others, because there's always this perceived perception to anything. And I look at people that have raised kids that I just idolize, that, man, this kid is the idealism of somebody who's respectful, who's this. But we never know what people are going through individually, whether it's positive or negative, that and how are those created. And because you also get kids that have just harder experiences that tend to be a little more rough around the edges. But if you were to ever peel those back, like coaches get to do, or maybe school teachers or our friends, you get to see a different side of a kid. And I think the work that, is upon us with this grant, and being able to connect in that way, is learning some of the things that I had just mentioned that we don't have in community. That if we could get this base understanding of what the macro world looks like, I think that transition would be a lot easier for some of our Indigenous youth, some of our Blackfeet youth. I would connect different modalities around economics teachings to some of the teachings we had as cultural people, where we have stories that connect us to different times in our timeline. And again, we aren't in the Western timeline. It isn't starts here. There's always this endless beginning and an end that has occurred in our culture for centuries, where we have these formations that are directly linked to stories that we have that are around all Montana, all the way up to northern Alberta, down to Yellowstone, all the way up to Saskatchewan. And it's not to say that we had rank or our territorial mindset that only came with colonization. We had this idea that it was given to us just to protect. But to be educated on that, I think, is very needed. I want to give another shout out to Mr. Kevin Kickenwoman, who is the Montana Teacher of the Year out of Browning. And he is the cultural advisor and cultural teacher at Browning High School. And he's been doing this for years. And you want to talk about how somebody who exudes a role that has allowed me to, I think, fill my role. And the more roles we get filled, the more I think we can bring people back in that essence. Recognizing through the generations, we would work with boarding school survivors. And as a trauma counselor, you're seeing a different part of the family. And you see on these symptoms when we're in community, right? Like a guy drinking, or a guy doing drugs, or a guy being crazy at the mall, or a mental health crisis, or a community crisis. We see those. I mean, those are all over TV, they're in the news. But we don't see is what creates those. One of the teachers that I've learned to learn about, Gabor Mate, who looks at addiction in a whole different way, has allowed me to see community in a whole different way. So then seeing trauma survivors in a different way is recognizing that the generational patterns from the historical trauma that I said, we can't be just stuck on that, that we got to understand those areas, is each area of generations have held on to whatever made them survive. One, because they're survivors, the resiliency, but the negative has also impacted them so strongly that they necessarily can't function at a level where, if you were to look out to communities and that person, like hypothetically, has a boat and a, maybe another house, we would look at that person who in our day and age was successful. And then we have types of success as Indigenous people where, you know, growing up and having your kids come back, you know, to your home, that's a success, where we look at people leaving and never coming home as a success, where our, that's the values, right? The different values and recognizing those, I think, has major impacts on how we even go about teaching. So I just want to give kudos to you guys, because you guys are learning about those while recognizing it, but then having people like myself and Jayla and others who are involved in this program recognize that it takes the community to create what is needed for them to like see the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't been done. You know, that I work on many levels, on a federal level, state level, tribal level. And we're now seeing these type of programs coming in and supporting community in ways I don't think we've been supported in a while. Because there's always been this perceived reality that they look at us in this way. Mm-hmm. But that, I think, has always been an internalized thought, because mm-hmm. I think when you take on certain roles of the people that have harmed you over time, those roles aren't so positive. And one of my favorite quotes from Apollo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed is, when the oppressed become the oppressors. That book will really give you insight on how the educational system has really took what we're trying to do now and then just threw it away. And was like, hey, we got to get rid of these types of things and we'll write it into policy. Have to abide by these set of standards. And then we do, because then we don't get funding. And that holistically has been hinged on federal policy, you know, since the 1930s and even more than that with the treaties that were implied on us. So I think having that understanding and knowing that could really be impactful too, to just understanding, well, I wasn't educated correctly. No one in my time during the early 2000s, it was called the No Child Left Behind Act. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a whole group of us that were left behind. And you can see how those federal policies trickle down to these organizations, because it didn't just affect Indigenous communities, it affected small rural communities, weren't afforded funding to provide certain pathways for students. Learning about that after gives you a different perspective on our timeline as a westernized culture, mm-hmm. as we've been, you know, colonized, and how we have then now learning and walking two paths. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we can really start to educate Indigenous youth, that you don't just have to choose. Mm-hmm. That we could create like grants like this to create pathways to learn differently. There's so many kind of us, you know, agents of change, people who are wanting to create newer pathways than we've had in the past 150 years. Because I think there is time where we're needing to just break away from this old and to just conceptualize anew. But we have to start to build foundations that are more human in nature. And I want to say that more than I say Indigenous. It's more, it's our Indigenous roots to Europe. It's, we're all tribal people as humans to Asia, to different parts of the world where we've all had tribal systems at one point in our timeline, and we have gone away from that due to knowledge that we have never really received with our hearts, but maybe only our minds. And that's why I'm very grateful to have, I think the teachers that I was really connected to was learning world geography and United States history, because it helped me better attune to, I think, the macro. I understood there was cultural differences because we grew up with heavy racism in Montana.
Yeah.
And to learn from that at a young age was to just be real. And to then live in that reality where you're almost growing up too fast.
Mm-hmm.
And what we know connected is the way we would raise our children,
mm-hmm.
and how that has changed. And it's not even on the father or the mother's end, but it's as a system.
Mm-hmm.
The resiliency that we've created from the loss of land and language and boarding school and family systems has been the resiliency of drugs, alcohol, unhealthy parenting from, you know, the people we were getting, we were getting abused from at the time, nuns. And they had culture too. They come from, you know, Europe cultures where they were more Catholic, but they still, the religion and the culture mixed, where then a lot of that was pushed on to a lot of our generations and families, and the learned behaviors from that. We're seeing that in real time with how we are communitying, if you will, because you can recognize the way we are in community isn't functional, and we aren't on the spectrum of just totally dysfunctional, but we do have a lot of chaos. And a lot of that is because we've been in systems where we've been in fight and flight. Then you take on not only, like we mentioned, the historical trauma, but the impacts from that and how that is just something we're living with. And to recognize that prior to all that, we had our own means and ways. And a lot of those were creating real self-actualized humans at birth. And that even stemmed in mom's tummy, where we created conversations and a space, if you will, like we do now for hospitals and this new wave of going to a more cultural, getting away from the westernized standards of labor to then going into these new, is even predicated on how we receive children into this world. On top of that, you know, we wouldn't allow, and those were even in the stories that I had brought up when we had first met, was the Itunkitaks, the lost children, and how in there we leave children. But why would we do that when we have so much high regard for children? And a lot of that through patterns and generations have been manipulated through story, basically for the value. One story that comes to mind, and it's in a time period where we were more into Western, but if you think about it, we were still living to the land back in the early 1920s. There was still a lot of tribal connection that was being had, even though there was a lot of this adversity. And I think there was a perfect example in Western culture, Abraham Maslow, who in his studies, and they call him the godfather of psychology, created what we have, the pyramid of self-actualization. And he actually visited the Siksika Nation, or Sitsigate, one of our sister tribes, during a very prominent time during his visit. And they get permission and they go to that tribe looking for deviant behaviors in tribal villages. And when he got to that village, he couldn't find anybody within the ceremonial camp of that time to have any deviant behaviors. He was very frustrated in his work that he couldn't get anybody to talk about others in the way he wanted them to. Like he asked, you know, what do you think about her dress? And they didn't have any conversation around that. They didn't have any understanding to it. So then you take that other concept, and it was he had to find that behavior in town. So there was a lot of boarding schools in that area, but there was a lot of day schools at the time. And there was a lot of kids that were in town that were primarily taken away from that life. he had to go into town to then work with some of the local youth in town to get some of those behaviors. And they were heavily influenced by the westernized culture of education, of colorism. So Abraham Maslow, in his studies, had come to the conclusion that this tribe, group of tribal people, were about 95%, if not higher, self-actualized. There was a young 1-year-old, 2-year-old boy who was just learning to walk, and he couldn't get out the door. He couldn't open the door. And Abraham was watching this, and he was watching all the adults ignore him in his tantrum, his crying. And as soon as the boy was able to get the door open on his own, they all jumped up and they praised him. They validated him and what he did, and helped him and supported him outside. And I felt like those were some of the core teachings of that failing system that I was talking about. Like, we had respect for, we didn't, like what we do in school, right, is we have rules. And if you don't listen, you get in trouble. And we didn't have those types of, because it was created in the culture on how to emotionally and mentally regulate young children. And a lot of that was through our ceremonies, the ones that I mentioned connected to the earth, our rituals that yearly took place on coming to age, the transition of how we did societies. We have a thing in our culture called transfer. And that is a very high thing to have transfers. And prior to what we have today, probably was more easier to attain, where it was just done as you got older. And the more things you did in community, the more you were validated. So the more you were transfer things. This young man, I seen he's grown up so well. He does good things for our community. Here, I'm going to give him this responsibility of looking after the tribe during night. Whether that was a thing or not, and most likely was, but it was that transfer and the validation of all of it. So you could take like the work we're going to do and how we can attune that style of learning to some of the modalities that is needed, because obviously we run on reports, we run on these grants. I love that I know both sides, because we have to be able to know that area to know how we then can service community in a most holistic pathway possible.
One of the things that has been weaved kind of throughout all of what you've said and is a really big part of this grant, so it's the way that we're teaching and learning, and something that's unique about this grant is really bringing in the youth voice. So instead of saying we're going to go deliver and implement and design a curriculum for youth, we're saying to youth, and you're part of the Pekani Youth Council, which I think is incredible. Like, what is it, youth, that you want, and how can we bring them along and teach them, you know, to help us evaluate this grant and teach in the grant? And so, like, bringing the people we're trying to serve along with us, so that when we are done at the end of the grant, we have this group of youth who've been a part of it and learned along the way. And so, just if you could talk a little bit about the Youth Council. And
oh yeah, thank you for bringing that back, because you know it matters, and our youth, I think, probably feel like they don't matter. And I think when we create spaces like this, it does create that connection to land, to their responsibilities, is if we could guide them. And this is where we need to start using maybe different language too, because I think even some of the language we use to support children puts them on this space where we're not speaking to them like we would an adult. And I think when we have the youth council that is there, it's creating these foundations. I really had this idea 5 years ago, and nothing really came of it because I didn't have the right tools myself. And there was like little guidance, and it was like you had to really learn. And that, sadly, that's been a part of a lot of my teachings, but there have been always a good foundation or a teacher that has supported that. And I'm really grateful that my journey has led me to be that for our youth now, where I remember being that voiceful youth coming back, and I wasn't even a youth, but I think compared to like some of the people that were out there doing things, all these older women and some of these ladies that are now past, oh, this young man, this boy. And I'm like, oh, I'm 24 years old, ma'am. And they were like, oh, you're still young, still wet behind the ears. I'm like, oh goodness, what's that mean? And hearing their wisdom and their maturity and their knowledge and culture and just being grandmothers allowed me to fail in front of them, to speak out of turn. And in that, they have softly guided me. And I think those, along with my teachings growing up with my cultural foundations, and I think that's what separates a lot of our community, is we have spaces that have those, but we also have more spaces that don't. I tend to fall. I have bad days. I think as humans, we have to recognize those. And I think in youth, we put so much pressure on youth to just be at this higher level, this higher standard within our policies, within our procedures, within our attendance, within all of it. We put them up there and we expect them to be better than us as adults sometimes. And we remember those feelings. Well, maybe that's a little bit of the system really breaking us down. And we recognize that. And a lot of that is the transfer. We would have people that would fight the system, and how we would support them to understand it or change it. And our systems, what we know today, are set in stone, kind of. And some of those, do we really follow as these massive organizations? And there's this shift in taking back control from what we know as this bigger system that I think we're all in. And how are we teaching that on this lower level? Because I work with youth, and I tell them all the time that, we as a school, public school, we get federal funding. So there's certain things that we get to have on away trips that maybe non-Indigenous or non-Native schools don't get. And a lot of that is you get fed. There's a federal policy that you have to feed these students, and we get monies for that. And it's appropriated by Congress, yada, yada. And as I'm working with the kids now, they're like, oh, thank you, coach. Wow, coach is rich. Coach is wow. And I'm like, this ain't my money. And I have to, and I'm the real part of me tells them the reason why we get so much money and you get fed is we're below a certain poverty line, that we as an economical system don't have these things that are creating jobs, that are creating, good housing markets. How are we teaching kids this? And we're not, we're not. And I'm really grateful that I think this is that start. And it doesn't have to be as radical as that, but where it can be is as honest and truthful as going through it through a trauma-informed lens. And some of those youth that we're working with have so much experience already. You can tell by the way they carry themselves and how they can maneuver through different higher level conversations. Just acknowledging, my experiences is my experiences, and I think all of us out there in the wider world, we all have our shared experiences, but to use those to be kind to yourself and to be kind to others, because that'll allow and shape spaces like that was given me today to open up and to be vulnerable, because it's needed.
I just wanted to reflect on a moment that I saw. So we had the Pekani Youth Council in the conference room, and we brought snacks, and you were there, and we were talking to them and just kind of trying to elicit from them, like, what if, we could look in the future and this youth council was super successful, what would it look like? And I was thinking it was going to be these huge monumental things, and it was really like just attainable things that were really practical and just well thought out. And you were talking to the youth, and they look up to you so much. You can tell by the way they look at you. And then there was a moment we were talking about something kind of difficult, and one of the youth kind of had a look, and you kind of put your hand over and said, like, I'm not exactly sure what you said, but you said, like, I know you've been through a hard time, and it seemed like there had been a recent suicide, or there was something really traumatic. And you kind of just in that moment, like, offered a little pat and said something that was reassuring. And it was just this really powerful moment of like not only saying like we're here for you, we see you, but also like just like also demonstrating that you can be vulnerable in like that kind of setting and that it's okay and it's professional. And it was like, I don't know, it was just like I've thought about that moment a lot. I don't know the story. I was, you know, we didn't talk about the story, but we just exchanged like this whole room kind of exchanged this like virtual hug, so to speak. And that was really from you, like you kind of demonstrating that to the youth. And I just thought that was a really powerful moment.
Thank you. I was just thinking back on that moment in my head. And yeah, you know, our community has been riddled with a lot of symptoms. And, you know, seeing them and the youth being so affected by them, just as we are as adults, and how I think we have either good or bad coping skills, but to see kids power through that. And, you know, we got to be able to, I think what I've learned is to be able to hold up an honest mirror. And if you're holding that up, you know, you can reflect so much goodness. And thank you for seeing that, because, you know, barely seldom we get that back to us. But I remember that moment, and I know James, and James, shout out James Whitcomb, his stud, becoming youth council representative, football and wrestling. And he's a community member too. And he's invested. And as a youth that is invested, it's really good to, I think, just get behind them. And that could be done in so many ways, because I think what you've seen was one instance. And I've gotten to have so many experiences with these guys where, you know, the energy that we had in that room, it was synergetic, it was connectable, and it meant something, because there's always intention to energy, and there's always energy with intention. And when you can weave those together with conversation and have youth have that, and to recognize that something hit us so hard that it was like a blanket, and just to get up. And I remember that. And I remember I put up my hand on his back, and I think I said it's okay not to be okay. Because just before that, you know, that's what I have to tell myself, you know, in these hard conversations, that I'm re-triggering myself through these experiences, and there are hard conversations. And to recognize that with our youth, to know that our youth are in that same boat and that we share same experiences, that's probably why I've recognized they've looked up to me. It's because I tell it like it is, and they can recognize that. And
Well,
I'm
you
just,
are definitely in it with them. It was not a like here I'm the teacher and you guys are the students. Like it is a collective learning situation and it is a force to be reckoned with and I want to be a part of it.
I'm so excited that you guys are a part of it, because I mean, just hearing that, you know, you guys took some of our already suggestions to like to the heart, and are already creating some of those intentional pathways right now as we speak. That to me is that synergy. I think we had that same feeling at the conference room. It'll continue to happen because there's a lot of intention that started this. And the only way we could lose that is if we don't galvanize around those youth.
Child support took a risk and applied for this grant. And there's a lot of reasons why you don't want to apply for a grant. There are a lot of work, there are a lot of reports, there's a lot of stuff to do. And it can distract you from your kind of core mission. But, you know, the Child Support Office just won an award recently. And part of why they won the award is because they do these wraparound services and they like really try to care about the person. Like they also have a job of enforcing. So it puts them in an awkward, you know, sometimes parallel path of trying to enforce child support, but also like create, and they seem to be this just hub of the community of like having veterans lunches and just all of these things. And but this is my perception, so I wanted to kind of just hear from you.
Yeah, and that is spot on, because it's creating this ripple effect. And that was based off of the system that I think George and his teams create. Agnes being one of those team members, a crucial part to that forward thinking, because there's always this like reality, because like we could talk about like, well, you know, it won't work because we're the, all these things, or just like, yeah, we're all these things, but hey, we got all these positive things. And that's what child enforcement does. It doesn't look at the negative. It looks at taking what's negative and correcting it, mm-hmm. or just going straight around it or running right through it.
It's also starting with the person, like, let's start with the assumption that someone wants to be a good father or parent, mother, and then let's empower them or help them. There are, like, are there people that could pay and refuse to pay? Probably, but let's assume that that's the very minority, and let's start with the assumption that everybody wants to pay. We just need to help them and put them and lift them up into a position where they can be a good father or mother and pay support and, you know, and besides financial support, like just emotional support for kids. But let's start with the assumption they want to, and that changes everything, I think.
It does. When I worked, one of my stories, and you know, if he doesn't like it, but I always tell it all the time, was I used to do the JRT, the job readiness training. And at Manpower, at the JRT, when I was teaching this as a YOA caseworker, one of my foundations is what you just said, is I'm no different than you. So don't think I'm up here giving you something I'm not. We're going to go through this together and we're going to learn. And Nico come into that program, and Nico is one of the amazing workers that Agnes has. And he came through that program, not struggling, because Nico was smart, but I think just in a different set of circumstances that his start was there. And to see him bloom into what he is today is just based off of that hard work I witnessed in the JRT. And I was hopeful that, you know, the type of teachings that I was being able to deliver then was allowing spaces for that.
Thank you for all of that. It's so good to hear your perspective. And I know you have 9 months to get to, so I will wrap it up, but I just want to thank you. I do want to sit in a cafe and just talk to you for hours.
Thanks again very much to TJ for joining us on the show today. And thanks, of course, to Maureen for doing a great interview and for helping to produce this episode. We'd love to hear from you and get your ideas and your feedback. And if you'd like to be a guest on the show, please reach out to us on the contact link on our website. News from the Peak is a project of Grace Peak Strategies and is produced by Maureen Life, David Ram, Robert Riddle, and me. You can learn more about us at gracepeakstrategies.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Grays Peak, and we're easy to find on Facebook and LinkedIn as well. This was News from the Peak. I'm Joe Mamlin. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, I'm looking out at the mountains. Hey, sorry, I'm lighting my smudge. It's helped me through this podcast to
it's kind of a very low pressure situation here. Awesome.
And I don't know Agnes at that level, but anytime she comments on my pictures, anytime she just mentions the good things, it really turns my day around.
Yeah. We were on a call not too long ago, and I told Jayla, it was with somebody at the school, and they were cousins, and they were talking about someone else who was cousins, and then they mentioned the third person. I go, oh, that's my cousin. And then they were like, what? And I was like, well, everybody else has a cousin here. I need a cousin.
Yeah, you're adopted in now. That's what I was telling Jayla.
You know, it wouldn't hurt to have the little king on there either.
Yeah. I know. I'm sorry too, because I feel like there was less questions and more of just me blurting randomized stuff.
I always forget to hit record, so.
Oh yeah, no, for real. And maybe if we can edit me back, hey, you know, edit me in jokes. But...
Joe is an expert editor.